Are you ready to unravel the mysteries of the ages? Tune in to Unlocking Bible Prophecies, where we dive deep into the prophetic books of Daniel and Revelation. In the book of Daniel, we'll explore the visions of empires, the mysterious 70 weeks, and the powerful prophecies that span centuries. From Babylon to the end times, Daniel holds the keys to understanding our world today. And then there's Revelation, the ultimate unveiling. John's visions reveal cosmic battles, heavenly worship, and the grand finale of human history. The seals, trumpets, and bowls, all pointing to Jesus' triumphant return. Whether you're a seasoned Bible scholar or a curious seeker, Unlocking Bible Prophecies is your compass. Discover hope, healing, and Jesus' unwavering love. So, mark your calendar. Every week, Naya Lupondwana and our guests will decode ancient symbols, connect the dots, and draw closer to the one who holds the future. Tune in to Unlocking Bible Prophecies on your favorite radio station, Adventist World Radio SID Media, at 2 o'clock on weekdays, because truth awaits those who seek it. Unlocking Bible Prophecies, where revelation meets transformation.
Welcome back, and thank you very much for tuning in. You're listening to Unlocking Bible Prophecies with me, Naya Lupondwana. We are together until the rest of the hour. We are joined by our guests who will be giving us some perspective, some insights, focusing on two chapters mainly. I can assure you they will be involving other chapters as well, but focusing mainly on chapter 2 and chapter 7 of the book of Daniel. Once again, good afternoon, and joining us, thank you very much, is Elder Methuselah Mjoli. We will be joined in a short while, I hope, by Pastor Kabasa. Please call us. Would love to hear from you. Send your voice notes, +27734703520. Again, send your voice notes, your questions, your comments to our WhatsApp line, +27734703520. Our guests are ready, willing, and able to hear from you and take your questions, your comments. Join in. Help us understand what we're studying here. And that's the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel, beginning today with chapter 2 and chapter 7 of the book of Daniel. Elder Mjoli, good afternoon to you. Welcome, and thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon to our listeners.
Thank you very much, Mdada. We are, like I said, we are hoping to be joined in a short while by Pastor Kabasa, who's going to be participating as well, is scheduled to be participating in this conversation with us on the subject of chapter 2 and chapter 7. Let's begin, Mdada, because we're running out of time, because we don't have just 1 hour. So, when we're talking about chapter 2 and chapter 7, what exactly is the overview of these chapters? Since Pastor Kabasa is not here now, so you will give us both overviews of chapter 2 and the overview of chapter 7. Go ahead, Mdada.
Okay, so chapter 2 opens up with a unique story. A story about a king who, obviously, in his rulership, is worried about the extent of his rule, and suddenly God gives him a dream during the course of the night. So he has a dream, he can't remember the dream, and so, like any other king who has wise men or other people who report to him who are supposedly wise and all-knowing, he gathers his wise men and astrologers and soothsayers and so on to explain to him what he had dreamed. Number one, right, he had forgotten what he had dreamt, but therefore requesting that the people can explain to him what he dreamt about, and, right, and obviously eventually also explain what he had dreamt. So we get into this interesting story within the king's courtyard. He's obviously forgotten what he's dreamt about, but it's worrying him because there seems to be some significance around the dream that he had dreamt. And so in his worry, he tries to get people, he's agitated. Yeah, tell me, what have I dreamt?
Yes.
And it's very interesting the responses you get from his wise men and some of the soothsayers. And here we're talking about people who are known to give answers when the king does not know the answer.
Right.
So, and when these Chaldeans, the wise men, soothsayers, and so on, come back to the king, they simply tell him, hey, what you asked from us, cannot be known by any wise man or so on. The only people really who can give you the answers you're looking for are the gods, and whose dwelling is not among men.
Right.
And that comes from the wise men of Babylon. So he becomes agitated, becomes annoyed. You're trying to play time with me. I'll basically burn you up and use your houses as dunghill, including your families, who also die, because you failed to give me that one thing I've been yearning to find all along. And so with all this agitation, Arioch is then sent out, who was the king's guard at that time, is sent out to gather all the wise men. And so the instruction comes out, we're going to burn you, we're going to kill you, because you couldn't give the king his answers. But obviously, like we began earlier on, Daniel, and Daniel is also part of the wise men. Now, he was on part of the crew that was present in the king's courtyard. And so he's made aware that they're going to die. So in his surprise and dismay, if you start reading from verses 24, therefore Daniel went unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Daniel, this is after he went back and said, wait, don't be hasty now. Let me go back and consult my God. I can come back and present the king what he had dreamt. And so he comes back. That very night, he prayed to God, the God of heaven, and God revealed the dream to Daniel, including the interpretation. So now he goes back to the king and is about to present to the king what the king had dreamt, and starts to relay the dream according to what he had seen and what he had been shown by God in his dream. So going back to the point you made earlier on in our first episode, so a dream is given to the king, but is also given to Daniel so that he can then provide the interpretation. He said, thou, O king, were asleep in your bed, and the vision upon thy bed were these. So you saw a great image, and the head was the head of gold, the chest and arms of silver, the waist of brass, the legs of iron, and the feet partly clay and partly iron. You beheld until a stone cut from no man's hand went and hit the statue at the feet, and it became as chaff, but the stone grew and became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. That is your dream, O king, and now the interpretation thereof. This is chapter 2 of Daniel. You, O king, are the head of gold. You can see Nebuchadnezzar starting to smile and become excited because now he's called the head of gold. So you, O king, are the head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and that with which is chest and arms of silver, and after that the waist of brass, the legs of iron, and eventually the feet partly clay and partly iron, and then the stone that hits the statue then goes and becomes a big mountain that represents the final kingdom which shall never be destroyed, representing the kingdom of God which shall stand above all other kingdoms. That basically is chapter 2. But Daniel sort of takes us through the interpretation and that takes us through the dream, which we'll go into detail once we start to really sort of trying to decipher who the head of gold is, just not of silver. That's chapter 2. But the interesting thing is how God decides to show the detail. And we often never ask these questions, is why did God choose to show the statue made of the head of gold, just right, not of silver, right, and so on and so forth? You'd understand that the gods of the pagan gods at that time were either gods of gold, silver, and all these precious metals. And so when you went to Babylon, you would see a god of gold, a god of silver, a god of this and so on. And so that became very sort of understandable or contextual in the mind of a Babylonian king or a pagan king.
Right.
But then you move over to chapter 7. So chapter 7 is basically the same dream now given to Daniel with more detail. So as you move across the book of Daniel, you realize that God almost starts with a very simplistic view and then expands as you get to further chapters and so on. So you'll see this notably becoming more and more until you get to the end of the book of Daniel.
Right.
So you get to chapter 7. Now God uses a different symbols altogether. He uses animals, and you would understand Hebrews were farmers and things like that. So again, contextually, relevancy, it would make sense in the mind of Daniel because he understands when you talk about a strong animal, you talk about a lion.
Sorry,
You're saying Hebrews were agrarian, but this is not necessarily about Hebrews. It was about Babylonians.
Definitely. But in terms of the choosing of the symbols, it was not a keen interest to be talking about a gold, silver, and so on. It was not really a thing, particularly with... They did not sort of ascribe value to those things as it were to the pagans, as an example. So you look at someone like Daniel, he would then understand more and the symbols more from an animal perspective. So God reveals chapter 7, the similar dream, but now uses different symbols. Right. So you have the lion, which represents the head of gold. You have the bear, which represents the chest and arms of silver, you see in the dream in Daniel chapter 2. Then you have the leopard, which represents the waist of brass. Then you have the terrible beast, which represents the legs of iron in chapter 2. And then eventually you have the 10 horns on the terrible beast of chapter 7, which represents the dividing of the 10 toes, which you see there after.
Right, right.
Yeah, so that's basically the contrast of what you see. But importantly, the same dream, same concept revealed to Daniel in chapter 7 is the same dream that would have been shown to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2. So ideally, that's what we're looking at.
I hear you. Let's go back to chapter 2. We are talking about Nebuchadnezzar here and him receiving this dream, and this dream he forgets. Is there any significance in forgetting, dreaming a dream, getting a dream from God, and then forgetting it? What exactly is that all about? Surely if God wants you to have a dream, he wants you to have a dream. But then again, forgetting it, what's that about?
And this is where you find that the humor side of God. So you begin to laugh at what he does and chooses to do. He obviously does not disclose or make sure the king forgets the dream so that it's easier to use one of his servants, being Daniel in this case, to reveal himself to a pagan king. And that sort of links up with Deuteronomy 29:29,
right.
It says the secret things belong to God, to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever.
Right.
So again, sort of cementing the fact that it's whatever's hidden is mine.
Mm.
So I also choose whether I want to reveal it or not.
Right.
And so in this case, the funny side of God is revealed, him choosing to use his servant to be the one that reveals himself. So again, his main quest was to reveal who the true God is, by making sure that Mr. Man forgets what he dreams.
Isn't that one of the problems, though, Mfundisi? And I'm saying this, and you can correct me, because today there are people who, using these scenarios in the Bible, decide God can't give me a dream and give me the explanation of the dream as well. I need to find somebody else. Why is it that we cannot be given a dream and the explanation of that? Why should I have to go and find somebody else? Isn't that the loophole that the devil is going to use to have people finding seers and osias in order to mislead people? Isn't the Bible perhaps opening up leeway for the devil to come and deceive?
You know what, Naya? That is actually a very valid and interesting point that you raise. And maybe something to sort of accompany what you're saying is that we tend to forget that in as much as we read the Bible, the devil reads the Bible too. So he can ultimately see where what notably we perceive as being gaps and exploit those, because people are very, very cunning in nature. I mean, for the mere fact that Eve was to go to a tree which was not meant for it to go, there's always that keen interest in the things that look sort of mysterious and things like that. But we also tend to forget that whilst God can give us visual dreams to dream about at night, the devil to a degree has a particular sway as to what we can conceive in terms of thoughts and things like that. But ideally, if you read the book of Ecclesiastes, the chapter is 5, the verse is 3, the Bible is clear in describing that for a dream cometh through a multitude of business. So, which could be related also based on our interests, things that we are worried about during the day could ultimately become our thoughts and so on. And because this thing is worrying us, like you're saying, the exploitation devil comes in between and sees that you are. I mean, let's look at it this way. If I'm really looking for a lovely lady out there, I'll keep, you know, thinking about her the whole day. Eventually, she forms part of what I dream about at night. from the multitude of business during the day. Again, so she forms a part of what I dream about at night. I'm so excited. I even tell people out there, the devil is listening. And so you'll go around looking to find answers to what you've been visualizing at night. And like you say, and it's easy for us to go to the soothsayers, the sangomas, and so on. And yet we forget a very clear text in the Bible, which I read earlier, that the secret things belong to God Alpha. They can do the guessing, all right, but they would never understand.
I want us to get into the detail now, Mdala, of chapter 2. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, I want to invite you once again as a watcher, as a viewer, as an audience, you who's watching us, who's listening to us, you're able to participate and contribute to the conversation. So feel free to send a WhatsApp voice note or call us, and the numbers you could use or the number you could use to send your questions and your comments is +2773-470-3520. Again, +2773-470-3527. I'll try and keep an eye on the WhatsApp line so we can see whether you have sent anything, and I'll read those texts as they come. All right, I think I have one now. Somebody else is talking about a whole different conversation there. They want to talk about the Trinity. All right, let's get into chapter 2, Mdal. We are talking about the head of gold. Just plot it for us in terms of history. We believe this is accurate. We believe this is correct to the T. Mm-hmm. It speaks literally of the kingdoms as they existed in history. Plot them for us as Daniel explains them.
Okay. So maybe the first question is why. Okay, we're going to get to the why specific kingdoms we're going to be talking about that we're going to be mentioning today, as opposed to other kingdoms that existed during that time. Some may talk about the Mayan kingdom, the Chinese kingdom, and so on, so which existed during that time. But I want to put it first out there that we are talking about kingdoms here that had a great effect or in terms of the people of God throughout time, including the second coming, up to the second coming. So these are kingdoms which have had significant influence or even opposed the people of God throughout time from where we're going to be starting off until the second coming of Jesus Christ. Okay. So that's the context, really. And people need to understand that. We could have mentioned other kingdoms, but God here is really stating what pertains to his people until the second coming. So the first kingdom in this case, the head of gold, being that of the golden kingdom. When Daniel says, you are the head of gold, he's talking about the kingdom of Babylon. Now, Babylon, according to Herodotus and other historians, they would tell us that the Babylon ruled from around 605 to 539 BC. Now, it was termed the golden kingdom because when you really look at what the historians tell us, gold was basically the fabric of everything that transpired within Babylon itself. It was called the Golden Kingdom of a Golden Age. It had a form of a square in terms of how it was built. Others say it would be as large as what Chicago is today. So four square built in a square. So that would be 22.5 kilometers on either side. The Euphrates River ran through the actual kingdom itself. In fact, it was guarded by the Euphrates River. You could not penetrate. For you to penetrate Babylon, you literally need to dry up the River Euphrates to get into Babylon. It had 53 temples, including the great temple of Marduk, which had over 180 altars dedicated to Ishtar. Like I said, the place was impenetrable. It had a golden image of Baal, which was one of the notable gods at that time, and a golden table very close. Each were around 25 tons, weighed 25 tons, made of pure solid gold. The chair in which the emperor or the ruler would sit in had two golden lions on either side, also made of solid gold, there was also a solid gold human figure about 5.4 meters high, made of solid gold. As you can see, purely a golden kingdom. And when you start to look at the metals, one of the things I want us to see as we go through the metals themselves is that they would start to be lesser in value, stronger in terms of they'll be stronger. So start with softer and get stronger and stronger and stronger. But they would also become longer and longer and longer. As you look at the head, it's smaller than the chest and arms and so on. So the length becomes a bit more, but the value begins to depreciate over time, looking at the different head versus chest and arms and so on and so forth. So then Nebuchadnezzar obviously rules his kingdom from 605 to 539.
Sorry, Mdala. You're mentioning this, and I need you to explain how does that apply to the kingdoms if the head is shorter than the torso and so forth, and if the head is softer and the torso becomes stronger and stronger up until it's iron mixed with clay. Apply that in terms of the kingdoms. Were kingdoms softer? Apply that for us.
Well, you basically look at the when you study the detail in terms of the interpretation, but also in terms of the softness. So this would relate to how the treatment in terms of their treatment towards the people of God. So they become harder and harder as you continue. Eventually, you get to the legs, which trample and break in pieces and so on. So that becomes the hardest of the lot. But more importantly, also, I think when we look at value, the depreciation of value, is no other kingdom was as wealthy as Babylon, for instance, in the kingdoms we're looking at, based on the things that I've alluded to and it being a golden kingdom and so on. But anyway, so 539 BC, Babylon gets conquered by the Medes and Persians. So you have Cyrus and you have Darius coming in and conquering Babylon, and they began to rule, and they were known as a kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. So they were particularly known for silver. You had to pay your taxes in silver. Again, God uses detail, which is very, very sort of relevant looking at the kingdoms we are talking about now. So they rule from around 539 to 331 BC. Again, when we look at history, we move towards zero from before Christ or BC.
Before the common era.
Cross over, go towards one, sorry. And once we cross over AD, we obviously move from the minimal to the highest number. So one onwards and so on. So if people may ask, why are we moving from 539 to 331? Mm-hmm. Are we moving backwards or forwards? That's how we look at time there. So chest and arms of silver, Medo-Persia, the two kingdoms, why it's called the Medes and the Persians is because these two kingdoms then rallied together to conquer Babylon. And after Babylon, after Medo-Persia, you have another interesting kingdom, which then rules from 331 BC, headed up by the young man himself, Alexander the Great, ruling from 331 to 168 BC. We know it to be the kingdom of Greece, primarily the primary metal that was used in Greece at that time was brass.
Okay.
They had brass weapons, they had brass armory and so on. So brass was a primitive metal that was used during the kingdom of the Macedonian, ruled by Alexander the Great. So some very interesting thing about Alexandra, which you pick up the detail in chapter 7.
Right.
Sorry, I did not refer to the difference between the two. So if you look at Babylon in chapter 2, it's the head of gold. You look at chapter 7, it's the lion. Again, lion being a primitive figure. When you look at drawings and everything else related to Babylon, you'll find lions everywhere. The two iron golden statues on either side of the of the chair of the king were also made symbolizing a lion. So there were lion symbols on either side. So then from chest and arms of silver, you had the two arms representing the two kingdoms themselves. Again, the Medes and the Persians. You get to chapter chapter 7. There's a bear with three ribs in its mouth, and one shoulder is slantier than the other, again representing that one of the kingdoms will have a greater rule as opposed to the other. So representing the Persians or the Medes, and again you have the three ribs, again adding more detail, which would represent the three kingdoms which would be conquered by the Medo-Persians just before the three other kingdoms they would have conquered during that known time. So that's Egypt, Judah, and so on. So again, when you get to Greece, it's the waste of brass. You get to chapter 7, Greece is now noted as the leopard, fast. A leopard, we know to a very fast animal. So the symbol, again, representing Alexander the Great, who conquered the world in a very short time. In fact, it's very interesting that when you study history, he had led his armies to over 20,000 miles in a space of 11 years. Being able to conquer the world in that short time. His teacher was Aristotle, the philosopher.
Right.
And And in the 15 years of his conquest, he had never lost a battle. So he was kind of selfish. He had named over 70 cities in his name. You would know a city by the name of Alexandria, again, named after Alexander the Great himself. Again, bronze there. So he ruled the world at that time, or the known world at that time, at a very short space of time.
He may have been selfish, or he may have been, his people at the time may have been as inauthentic as we are today in South Africa. We name every boulevard Nelson Mandela Road, Nelson Mandela Drive. Everything is Nelson Mandela. There is no boulevard in South Africa that doesn't have Nelson Mandela Drive. So it may not necessarily be him being selfish, but just people being unimaginative. Sorry, I'm interrupting. Go ahead.
Yeah, the difference with South Africa and them, he himself is the one that names the cities according to himself. Okay. So there's a major difference there.
Yeah.
Okay, so now looking at the kingdom of brass versus the leopard in chapter 7. So obviously the wings on the leopard representing speed, the amount of speed in which it takes to conquer the world. But an interesting detail is that when you get to chapter 7, Greece is then represented as a leopard with four heads. So we know Alexander the Great conquered Medes and Persians, but what is the significance of the four heads that you see on the leopard? So very interestingly, after he conquered the world, his soldiers became very tired, and he just wanted to go on and killing and so on. Eventually, the soldiers were like, man, we've been out here for 11 years. We haven't seen our families and so on. So eventually, he conceded, went back home. They had a huge party, and he drank. Now, there's obviously a mystery around how his death came. Others say he drank and eventually died, or others say he had pneumonia, the malaria, and so there are different stories around it. But the interesting detail is, at the point of his death, his wife Roxana, who was pregnant at the time, asked him a very interesting question. So, and you've done all this killing, you've conquered the world, but who shall rule after you, because you don't have a son to take over your rule once you're dead? And he said something very interesting on his deathbed. He said, the strongest shall rule. And when he says the strongest shall rule, it's very interesting that when he passed away, his four generals then sort of clamored together to break the kingdom of Alexandria into four parts. And so you have Lysimachus, Seleucus, Ptolemy, and Cassander, obviously fighting to have these four kingdoms. And that broke the kingdom into the kingdom of north, the kingdom of the south, the kingdom of west and east. So you had the four divisions of Greece at that time. So hence the four heads that you see on the left there. And leading us from that, you find the Battle of Pydna, where then the Greeks lose to Rome, and Rome obviously takes over, and they then are the legs of iron in chapter 2 of the Book of Daniel, and they are the terrible beast which you find in chapter 7, which has the 10 horns that you see. So Rome takes over Greece, and Rome is known as the Iron Monarchy of Rome. I mean, it was the iron nails that they ruled during the time of Christ, you would notably know, historically. So it was the iron nail that pierced Jesus' hands. It was the iron spear that basically went into his side. Again, iron. Rome was known as the Iron Monarchy. But it doesn't mean they had not learned from the cultures of the Greeks and the kingdoms that came before. The Greeks were well known to really sort of educate all other nations based on their culture, which is called Hellenism.
Right.
And they imparted a great deal of their culture even to the likes of Rome itself.
Okay.
So that's why you find Rome building plenty of roads using what we call today as concrete, having learned from the Greeks and so on, so roads and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. Hold the thought.
We'll
get into a bit more detail. I want us to be as textual as can be, Dada. Before we go to my question, there's a question here from Anonymous. It reads, there is no Africa in these countries, Mdala is mentioning Singenapi in this prophecy, and does it mean Africa did not exist then? Like, really? That's the Anonymous there. We'd like to respond there, Mdala.
Well, it's a very interesting question. When we study the location of where Babylon is, where if you remember carefully, the likes of I just want to make sure I remember the full location is. But if you study the notable history we are talking about, it, and especially when these four kingdoms start to break up, a few of these kingdoms then move over towards the south and the east and the west and so on. The kingdom of the south, in this case, was known to be Egypt. So Egypt plays a part as an African country within these, particularly in the division of the four kingdoms. But more than anything else, it's understanding, like I said, contextually, let's just understand God's people throughout time. So there is an inclusion of God's people, which includes people of Africa and other places of the world, once we get closer and closer to the end of time. But ideally, there's a natural movement from the literal people of God, including the spiritual people of God, as the detail expands.
Right, right.
As we go through the Daniel itself, yeah. So there is traces of Africa.
Yeah.
And everything happens within the borders of Africa and so on.
Yes,
so
yes.
Iraq is there. Iraq is there being the Babylon we know today, or the Babylon we are talking about today was Iraq at that time. So, yeah.
So I can imagine if Pastor Kabasta was here, he was going to add to say, when we speak of the scriptures as we have them, the scriptures occur and exist in the context of Africa. The Bible that we have right now was found, or at least it was inspired to Moses on Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is in the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. When we speak of the territory that was taken over by Alexander, it includes Egypt and Libya and all of North Africa. When we're speaking of Hellenization that you were talking about, all of that territory was Hellenized up until the Arabs came in. That's the territory of Africa. So to say Africa is just there in the shadows, that person is mistaken. I totally agree with you, Mdala, that Africa plays a very large role in the prophecy, because as we speak in Africa today, there's a place called Alexandria in Egypt. As we speak right now, so you'll still be able to find traces of the prophetic lands and territories there. This person comes back and says, "So, akuna black people?" And then they've got four emojis of wonder and shock. Please respond to them.
Race is immaterial, particularly when you look back at that time.
Right.
You had blacks, you had plenty of black people. I mean, We are now divided by countries and things like that. So we often think that black people did not exist in the place of Iraq and so on and so forth. The Bible is very clear. Even during the time of Christ, we all know about Philip. We all know about the man who carried Jesus' cross.
Simon of Cyrene.
By descent. Correct. Yeah, Simon of Cyrene. So all these and it's a sad fact. One of the things we need to admit throughout history is that the less detail about Africa's participation in the notable biblical history that exists out there. So we may not talk about it, but ideally it's there. And the Bible is also not necessarily expounding more on the races. It's expounding more on God's people and the point of relevancy at that point in time.
Yeah. All right, this person is
But
happy.
We'll also see something interesting once we get to the destruction once we get to the splitting of the kingdoms, which is the 10 toes and the horns that you find in Daniel chapter 7.
Right.
Rome obviously becomes a notable kingdom. And because the other countries around were not happy about the rulership of Rome, you find Africans particularly, which at the time were called the Vandals. Yeah, Africans was known as the Vandals. That's south of the kingdom of Egypt. You have the Vandals coming in who are very not happy with the rulership of the Roman Empire at that time. In fact, that's where the word vandalism comes in, because they would destroy the heads of the statues of the Roman emperors and so on and destroy those things because they were not happy, particularly about the worship of deities that had no context within the Bible. And so they would destroy the statues there. They were called Vandals and hence vandalism.
Yeah, okay.
So you see the participation of Africa again extended even to the time of the Roman emperors.
I'll invite you for another conversation just about that part, Mdala. The person says they are happy with your answer. Thank you, Mdala. Well answered. So I think they are happy with your answer. On our stream on YouTube, we do have Blake Mumalo saying race is immaterial in biblical prophecy. Well, do you want to respond to Blake Mumalo, Mdala? Go ahead.
Yes, I think more than anything, yes, I would agree with you. Immaterial. At the same time, we need to be careful, particularly when you deal with our people, to sort of make sure that, yeah, even though it looks immaterial from a biblical perspective, but there's a vast participation of African people within the context of the scriptures, okay, and even Bible prophecy.
All right. If you're listening to us right now, you're listening to us via our app or on the World Wide Web. We are able to reach you and you are able to reach us via our WhatsApp line. You could send your voice notes. We'd love to hear from you. You could send your text messages. You could call in. Let's engage on the issue of chapter 2 and chapter 7 as interpreted by Dara. The number to dial or the number to send your voice notes to is +27734703520. That's if you're outside the borders of the Republic. If you're within the borders of the Republic of South Africa, you can just say 0734703520. Again, 0734703520. That's how you can send your views. We're also available on YouTube, the SID Media, and on Facebook, the SID Media. Any means by which you'd like to contact us, would like to hear from you. All right. So, Mdala, let's just get into the detail now. You were able to say it was Babylon. It was the yes. Medo. Yeah, it was the Medes and the Persians. It was, yes. And then we saw Greece and then Rome. Yes. I need you to help us understand how you arrived. Does the Bible mention that this is exactly how it is? Or do we have a way of attributing kingdoms to these beasts and to the statue there?
Okay, so first and foremost, there is an understanding from how these kingdoms then move from each other. So the Bible obviously represents the conquest of each kingdom, or the arising of each kingdom through a conquest. So we know Babylon, after Babylon, Medo-Persia came in and began to rule. It is very clear. But the Bible also sort of indicates to us in different passages of the scripture,
right,
and begins to notably make us aware of who we're talking. An example of this is that years before the Medes and Persians conquered Babylon,
right,
the God, through the prophet Isaiah, made us aware that Cyrus would come and the gates of Babylon. Let's just read the text quickly. Isaiah 45, the verses 1. If you read the verses before that, you'd also understand that God looks at him as he uses him as a symbol of Christ, almost being there present to help deliver his people there from Babylon. So chapter 45, verses 1, thus said the Lord to his anointed. At that time, Cyrus was not even present.
Right.
But we able to pick up from the scripture that already God was talking about Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. This obviously representing the kingdom of Babylon. So after they redirected the channel and redirected the channel of the river Euphrates and came in under the walls of Babylon and conquered Babylon that very night. Yeah.
So we
get instances like that. Yeah.
I was hoping that we'll get into chapter 2 from verse 39. Perhaps we can just begin from verse 36. Daniel chapter 2, verse 36. This was the dream, and now we'll interpret it to the king. You, O king, are the king of kings. Yay. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. Mm. Verse 39, after you, another kingdom will arise, inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet had toes, blah, 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 blah. It continues. Again, my question here, Abdallah, is he doesn't tell us that this is Medo-Persia. He doesn't tell us this is Rome. He doesn't tell us that this is Greece. How did we How do we have the confidence to say, actually, this is Medo-Persia, this is Greece, this is Rome? How do we arrive at that? Are we using history purely, our grasp of history? Or does the Bible plainly put it as, this is Rome? Because as far as Daniel chapter 2 is concerned, it doesn't.
Okay. So in as far as Daniel chapter 2, it does not necessarily name the kingdom themselves.
Right.
But as you continue to read the book of Daniel, you begin to establish the kingdoms themselves being named throughout the scripture. So turn with me to the book of Daniel chapter 10 as an example.
Right.
If you go there, if you go, maybe let's start with Daniel chapter 6.
Okay.
So. Okay, maybe let me make it easier.
Whilst you're paging them, Mdala, I have another question here for another anonymous person who decided they're going to use my direct device here. It says, but the Vandals were not African. You remember when you said the Vandals, I squinted a bit there. So this person is saying, but the Vandals were not African. They were Germanic tribes originating from Poland. While they settled in North Africa as well as Spain, Italy, and Gaul, which is what France, but they do not originate from Africa. This is anonymous. Okay. Would you like to respond to anonymous there, Mdala?
Yeah, like he says, as others settled in North Africa, so you have the ones from North Africa also participating in the destruction of the symbols. So in terms of origin, maybe not necessarily, but we do know that these Vandals were also coming from Africa, vandalizing the statues.
So I think that what is responding to is how you portrayed it. And I want to explain why. Okay. I squinted myself. because it created the impression that Africans are Vandals. And now when you see vandalism, it's an African phenomenon. And then also, most importantly, you created the impression that they come from Africa. They are African. You said they are Africans. And that's how Africans come into the picture. That was in response to another anonymous talking about the presence of Africans in scripture. You said, yeah, Africans appear because they were Vandals. And that's how we come to the name vandalism. That's why I squinted. And this anonymous is saying, but then again. So just clarify that.
Apologies, anonymous. But I think the point we're trying to make is African participation, yes, even though it's not, their origin is not necessarily African, but we do know historically that participation from some of these who settled in North Africa, and in settling there, the idea is some of them would typically be African because they are settled in Africa, and so you find them participating there. But in terms of origin, maybe not really. But what we are saying is that, yeah, Africa does participate in prophecy, whether we like it or not. It may not necessarily be physically within the context of a particular location, but we do know that throughout the course of the prophetic history, eventually when you get to end, you see that it includes everyone.
Right.
And
right.
Includes us from the point of looking at God's participation in the affairs of life.
All right.
But the other maybe important thing to gather from chapter 2 is that,
sorry,
as we're reading.
Before you go there, I want to just, Blake comes back again. He says, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and pagan Rome are mentioned in the Bible, although we do need to match the symbolic description to those kingdoms. Would you want to respond to Blake again there, Dan?
Yep, he's correct. So there's the symbolism part, which we did go through while I was explaining the head of gold, chest and arms of silver, and so on and so forth. But the other thing that's very interesting is that if you really do study the book of Daniel, it continues to give us indications of where these kingdoms fit in. So for instance, I was going into the book of Daniel chapter 10 as an example. He says, in the third chapter 10, this is where you meet the actual term Persia being introduced in the Bible. Chapter 10 of the book of Daniel. So you said Daniel chapter 10 verses 1, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel. Are we together?
I'm here.
Whose name was Belteshazzar. So here we see Persia, Medo-Persia being mentioned in the Bible. You go to chapter 11 of the book of Daniel. Again, reading from verses 1, In fact, verses chapter 10, verses 20 again. Chapter 10, verses 20 again. Then said he, knowest thou wherefore I come unto thee? And now I will return and fight with the prince of Persia. And when I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grisha shall come. Ah, you're seeing the Bible again expounding. So these names are literally coming into play as the book of Daniel continues. So Persia was introduced. And it says, once the prince of Persia is gone, the prince of Grisha shall come. And naturally, after the prince of Grisha, we know that Rome becomes the participating empire that comes after. So the Bible does name these countries.
Is Abdullah suggesting that these references are with respect to the kingdoms that are mentioned in chapter 2?
Chapter 2, yes.
Okay.
So if you put the dots together, yes, if you put the dots together, so right. Daniel is present during the rulership of Nebuchadnezzar, right, as well as his grandson.
Right.
So in chapter 6 of the book of Daniel, we see in chapter 5 of the book of Daniel, we see the Medes and Persians coming. You remember the handwriting on the wall, Mene Mene Tekel Upharsin. That was almost the last day of the rulership of the kingdom of Babylon. And you see the Medes and the Persians come in. Daniel is still kept alive because once you get to chapter 6, Daniel is present in chapter 6, but it's no longer Babylon that rules. It's the Medes and the Persians. So you have Cyrus the king ruling there, and he makes it very clear that when we read chapter 10 and verses 1, he's again shown a vision during the third year of the rulership of Darius, of Darius the king. So again, so you see the movements as across. And then the angel comes again to Daniel and says, after the prince of Persia shall you get the prince of Grisha come in. So he's battling. So there's a whole warfare that's taking place, and God is supremely involved in the affairs of life.
Okay.
But the other interesting thing you find in chapter 2 is the fact that God is involved in the establishing in setting up and setting down kings. So he's hugely involved on who becomes king and who does not become king. So it almost gives us the comfort that although we see things taking place in the world out there, God is still pretty much involved in the affairs of life. So we may be concerned as to who's ruling now and who's not ruling now, but ultimately God is still in control no matter what we see.
All right. So explain the toes there. You partially explained Rome being the Iron Kingdom, but who is the clay?
Okay. So if you study the Bible, the Bible continues to say now, as iron, this iron monarchy, which is pagan Rome at that time, shall rule the world and so on and so forth. Then eventually its kingdom shall be divided into 10 kingdoms. So the 10 toes there represent the 10 or the division of Western Europe of Rome during that time. So Rome, pagan Rome, became a very interesting nation because ultimately if you read the history, the books such as Edward Gibbon's The Rise and Fall of Rome, he tells us that Rome was basically conquered within itself. You know, certain practices and things like that eventually began to erode the kingdom of pagan Rome. And ultimately, things could not stand. And that very nation itself, in its supreme nature, became divided. And in its division, then came rise to the 10 divisions of Rome as we know them today. So it was the Alemanni at that point in time, which is now known as Germany, Franks, the Franks, which we now know as France, Burgundians, which is Switzerland now, Suevi, Portugal, Vandals, which were exterminated over time, which we'll explain once we get to chapter 7 again.
You were coming nicely there, Abdullah. You were coming nicely. Yeah. You were explaining who's who. Just continue with all 10. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Vandals, yes. You had the Visigoths, Spain. You had Anglo-Saxons, which are known as...
Who are the Vandals?
Yes. The Vandals... it's not really clear who the Vandals are.
Okay.
Because the notable Vandals... And again, going back to the point around the northern side. So you may claim Poland, but here we are talking about those who settled in North Africa, not
That's
necessarily
right.
the
That's
Poland
right.
version of...
Okay.
Yes. Continue. And then you get the Visigoths, Spain, then you get the Anglo-Saxons being England, you get the Ostrogoths, which we don't necessarily know because that whole place was exterminated. We'll get into the detail later on. You've got the Lombards, which is Italy, and Heruli, which obviously over time also became exterminated. So all these three other divisions of Rome were exterminated closer to around 508 or 538 BC.
Okay.
So 508, yes. So once these kingdoms were there, then it became the 10 divisions of Rome as we now know it. You get to chapter 7. Again, these horns, according to...
My question was on the clay. Yes. What is the significance or meaning of clay mixed there with that metal?
Okay, so obviously knowing that metal and clay does not necessarily mix.
Correct.
It will always... Yeah, you try and mix the two, it won't necessarily mix. So these 10 kingdoms themselves will try and be unified in their conquest. Daniel chapter 2, I think it's verse 43, says... Right. They shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. That's verse 43. And many have tried. I mean, Napoleon once said in his journal, there shall be one Europe, there shall be one currency, there shall be one language, and there'll be one government. And eventually at the Battle of Waterloo, after he lost, he said, God Almighty is too much for me. Trying to unite all these kingdoms of Europe. Even Hitler himself tried. He said there will be one people, one empire, one leader. He himself also tried and failed. We now talk of the Euro, Brexit. They tried to come together. Even that could not work. Till today, they've been trying to mingle and come together and be as one. But they'll always never cleave, because the Bible predicted that they shall try and come together, but they shall not cleave. And the Bible also states it's that during the time of those kings, God shall then come and establish his kingdom, which shall last forever and shall not be destroyed. So it's understanding that where we are now, we're in the kingdom of the 10 kingdoms, a division of the 10 kingdoms, and not too far from now, Jesus is about to come to settle and to establish his kingdom that shall not be destroyed.
So is that what we mean when we speak of mixing of clay and iron?
Yes. So the mixing of clay, and the Bible is very descriptive, is very clear on what it means. They shall try and come together as one. They shall try, they shall not cleave one to another. So this is what we mean by them trying to to come as one, just to have one rulership, to go back to an imperial Rome, or to have one kingdom that basically rules the whole world.
I ask this, Mdala, because we in history we have seen a time when there was a great empire that was ruled by Ahasuerus, which spanned all the way from Ethiopia to India, 126 territories under one man. There was a great unity at the time. Surely it cannot be referring to kingdoms. And through the Adventist theology, we've heard some people suggesting that it doesn't mean kingdoms there. There's something else it means. And I was wondering if perhaps you might bring that other part. What does it mean for the clay and the metal or the iron to mix there? Are these kingdoms that don't mix? Actually, there is a person who is.
I know.
Let me read this message from YouTube.
Amalgamation of church and state.
That's exactly. Blake Ngumbalo is saying clay and iron is the amalgamation of church and state. So that there you go. How do you respond to that, Mufta?
No. It's basically true. I think the starting point is to understand in the context of these nations. So if you study the image, it breaks down into 10 kingdoms. And again, to your point earlier, you would say, but there have been notable empires which have tried to bring kingdoms together. Again, in the context, like I mentioned earlier, here we are dealing particularly around kingdoms that have a major influence with regards to God's people. And they shall try, yes, and mingle with the seed of men, but shall not cleave. So they shall try, they again shall try to come together and as one, and to have this global union which rules with both church and state, but it shall never come to pass. Eventually, God will establish a kingdom and shall last forever. The other thing that is basically important on the point...
Sorry, Mdala, forgive me. We invited them to participate, and now they are participating. So let me just read their messages. Here's another message. Why are these kingdoms of the global north, i.e. they only represent Western empires? Where are the empires of China, Mongolia, Aztecs? What sets these empires that they are mentioning in scripture while others are excluded? Do you want to respond to them? Because I think I've got three questions here. So I'm going to give you the opportunity to respond to that one first. Go ahead.
Let's start with the first one. I think the person was not there when we started by explaining that we are looking at kingdoms that have had impact or have had some impact with the people of God. So Judah, as we now know it, was besieged by Babylon. So moving across these nations, they have been involved in either persecuting of God's people or basically having basically taking over the rulership of God's people or having an impact on God's people. So where God's people are suffering, they're involved. So you have right. Babylon there, you have Mesopotamia there. So the context is around God's people.
Okay.
And if we're to include the others, they are not necessarily included in this particular
context. The second question there says, I note also the absence of the British Empire, which is suspected of being the greatest in history. So what's the criteria for being a biblically mentioned empire? Go ahead.
Okay. So like we mentioned earlier, in the context of the vision and in relation to God's people throughout time, it doesn't mean Britain is not there. I mean, the Anglo-Saxons, if we're looking at the 10 kingdoms or the division of the 10 kingdoms, Anglo-Saxons, Britain, the great portion of Britain is contained within the Anglo-Saxon people. So what we now know as England is,
Okay, final question, and then we're going to run out of time soon. It says, on clay, never mixing with I suspect they meant to say iron. On the clay, never mixing with iron, the lingua franca of business in English, is that not a form of unification under the ideology of one empire, which is interestingly antithetical to the confusion of language at the Tower of Babel. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, very true. I mean, We all know when people come together what they can achieve. The Tower of Babel is one indication of that. And God could not have something similar to that during the course of history ever again. And so that's the reason why he confused language and you know, people were then scattered across the expanse of the world. And if we are to go back to that, imagine what men could achieve if they come together.
Okay.
And yeah.
All right. Final one from Blake Numa. Last thing I think these people have been studying, preparing for you, Abdallah. Blake writes, this refers back to Genesis chapter 6, where the sons of God went into the daughters of men. Sons of God are the church, and daughters of men are the seed of man. Or the state. Mdala, we've got 3 minutes between you and I, so I'm going to give you 2 minutes and then I'll close. Go ahead.
Very deep. I think as we continue the scriptures, we will then start to introduce the merger between church and state. I think the main emphasis of chapter 2 is to look at the movement of these kingdoms up until the kingdom of God comes into play at the end, very end of time. The important thing to consider here is God's notable participation in the history of the affairs of life. He sets up kings, and that's what we need to consider. Throughout the confusion that we see in the world today, God is still in control. And with him being in control, through the mysterious changes that we see in the world today, we should never at any point of our life doubt the fact that God still has a sway in the affairs of life.
Right.
What we do need to find comfort in is understanding that throughout the journey, we just see his hand playing a role and making sure that we are not consumed by what the world has in store for us. Yes.
All right. Mdala, I'm going to leave it there. It's a good thing, perhaps, that we had Pastor Kabasa not here so that you can get the opportunity to answer all these questions coming through thick and fast. We'll continue our conversation with Mdala and Pastor Kabasa. Hopefully, Pastor Kabasa will be joining us next time on Friday, same time between 2 and 3 here on Live at Adventist World Radio with me, Nayelu Pondwa. Mdala, thank you very much. We really appreciate your time and your insights. Looking forward to our conversation on Friday.
Thank you.
All right. That's Mdala Methuselah Mjoli, and Elder Mjoli is going to be back again on Friday. From me, Nayelu Pondwana, and the team, have a wonderful day.
Are you ready to unravel the mysteries of the ages? Tune in to Unlocking Bible Prophecies, where we dive deep into the prophetic books of Daniel and Revelation. In the book of Daniel, we'll explore the visions of empires, the mysterious 70 weeks, and the powerful prophecies that span centuries. From Babylon to the end times, Daniel holds the keys to understanding our world today. And then there's Revelation, the ultimate unveiling. John's visions reveal cosmic battles, heavenly worship, and the grand finale of human history. The seals, trumpets, and bowls, all pointing to Jesus' triumphant return. Whether you're a seasoned Bible scholar or a curious seeker, Unlocking Bible Prophecies is your compass. Discover hope, healing, and Jesus' unwavering love. So, mark your calendar. Every week, Naya Lupondwana and our guests will decode ancient symbols, connect the dots, and draw closer to the one who holds the future. Tune in to Unlocking Bible Prophecies on your favorite radio station, Adventist World Radio SID Media, at 2 o'clock on weekdays, because truth awaits those who seek it. Unlocking Bible Prophecies, where revelation meets transformation.